Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is This Week in Radio Tech, episode 112, recorded January 18th, 2012. Dude, where's my satellite? This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by the Telos Alliance and the astonishingly gorgeous Now catalog, featuring diagrams, color pics, techie specs, and many words of modern radio wisdom. Telos will mail it to you free, and you can download the PDF. Get yours at telosalliance.com/now. It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hi there, I'm Kirk Parnak. Glad that you are along. This is our 112th episode. That just seems like seems so much more than 110 or 111 that we had just a few weeks ago. Hey, we're back and glad to be here. We were off last week for the CES coverage, the live coverage that the TWiT Network did. But we're back this week and should be back for many, many weeks to come. So glad you're here. Well, we have with us one of our co-hosts, one of the original co-hosts on the show. And that is from the Manhattan, New York, the best-dressed engineer in radio. It's Chris Tobin. Hey, Chris, how are you?
I'm good, Kirk. And yourself?
Good. Good. What's up with you in your world?
My world? Well, things are pretty busy, but it's a good busy. At Musicam, where I'm working, we've got a lot of good stuff going on. And today is a nice day with the weather here in New York City. And then being in black and white, it's pretty wild. It's like thinking, wow, an opportunity to be an old-time TV video and actually do something. So I'm just moving around. It's like, wow, look at that. It's black and white. Yeah, I have nieces and nephews. I have no idea what black and white is.
Man, I remember watching all the old shows in black and white, like Twilight Zone. Oh, that wasn't black and white. Dark Shadows. Oh, that was in black and white, too. Star Trek. I watched Star Trek in black and white, and that was a color show. But all we had was what brand of TV did you have as a kid?
My first black and white television, the first television was a Sharp vacuum tube, CRT, 10-inch, little mechanical tuner. It was a rotary tuner, so when you turn the knob, it clicked, it had indentations. That was the first. The family television we had years later in my youth, a color television. It was a console type. So if you could picture approximately a 5-6 foot wide piece of furniture, in the center was the television tube, and on either side were the speakers, and then on the top you had a covers that you'd pop open, and you get access to an AM/FM tuner, also a Victrola turntable, record player, whatever you like to call it.
Yeah,
it's an RCA model, RCA model that was, and we had a portable turntable or Victrola, which was Zenith, which had the Cobra tone arm, had the little eyeballs.
Now you're using the word Victrola to mean a record player, not a Victrola brand player.
That's correct.
Okay,
because that was the slang. It's like when you say facial tissue, you call it a Kleenex. That's really a facial tissue.
I never called a record player a Victrola. I thought a Victrola was a Victrola.
Family members growing up. That's how they told us as kids. You know, they just say, hey, go and put a new record on that Victrola.
Don't flip the record over on the Victrola.
So when I watch those old movies and people talk and do those things, it's like, that was my childhood. Oh, boy, do I feel old now.
Wow. We had a black and white TV that was ostensibly a portable. It had a big honking handle on the top of it. I don't know that the handle would hold the weight of the TV. And I'm trying to think of the brand name. It came from Sears. It may have been Kenmore, but I don't know that it was. Was there another brand that Sears called their own? I'm watching the chat room. Maybe somebody. No, it wasn't Admiral. And it wasn't Victrola. I don't know what it was. It may have been Sears or Kenmore. And I remember that thing would just break so often. And we didn't have any money. So my dad was a college professor at the time. And he had students who claimed to know something about electronics, right? So they would, a student or two would come over. No, it wasn't a Vizio. So the student would come over to the house and tromp down to the basement where we kept the TV set and then the old ratty sofa. And they'd open up the back of the TV set and pull all the tubes out and run them down to the grocery stores, IGA or A&P or something like that, and put them all into the tube tester. And lo and behold, you know, none of them had a problem. So I even remember getting in the car, driving to Wichita, Kansas, which was 35 miles away. And somehow we found a store that carried flyback transformers. Remember flyback transformers? So, put out, you know, 20,000 volts. And so this guy thought that the chat room saying silver tone may have been a silver tone. It certainly was not a top of the line. Well, I don't know. I don't remember if we fixed the TV this way or not, but my dad bought the flyback transformer. We brought it back. I remember solder flying everywhere and putting all the tubes back in. I wish I could remember if it worked after that or not. But, what memories of that thing. And the antenna on the roof with the twin lead coming down. And, you know, it would get two of the Wichita channels, but it wouldn't get channel 12. And that was the one that had the Star Trek reruns. And they were all fuzzy. Oh, they were just so bad fuzzy. Turned out one side of the 300-ohm twin lead was broken. And, I think just before we moved out of Winfield, Kansas, we figured that out and fixed the twin lead. So I saw maybe three Star Trek episodes, you know, in full living, you know, black and white without snow. I guess, Chris, you grew up in a metropolitan area when reception wasn't such a problem.
Yes, that's true. In the metro area, you could get stuff with the proverbial coat hanger you chose if you broke the the monopole antenna. Reception was fine, but watching things with snowy multipath conditions sometimes didn't matter because the content, which was the television show you wanted to watch, is what it was all about. That kind of thinking, I think, still holds true today with the radio and even modern television with HDTV and folks trying to get it off the air in their apartments or houses in the suburbs. When they want to fight off their cable or other means of getting television channels.
So we'll turn our nostalgic attention to television, to radio in just a moment. But just to spend another minute on television, the one thing that I remember the most watching on television was we just moved to Winfield, Kansas in 1969, the hot, sweaty summer of 1969. And these two guys had Allied Van Lines or somebody had moved all of our stuff, moved it all in. It was just it was me and my dad and I think my brother. And we had left my mom and two sisters back in Louisiana. They were going to come up in a few days later, but they wanted all the furniture in place first. So we got the TV on. We got some rabbit ears sort of arranged right then. We didn't have the antenna on the roof yet. And what did we watch at, you know, like 1 o'clock in the morning? The moon landing. And, just thinking about that just still just sends shivers up my spine and just elates me. I just think it's so fantastic. There we were in 1969, not exactly huddled because it was hot, okay? But we were in the living room, and there's the TV set with a coat hanger or something, rabbit ears on it, trying to get the Wichita stations. And of course, we had our choice of any station at that point because they all were carrying the moon landing. There it was. The moon landing. And now we can turn our attention to radio. Spent many, many nights with one of those five tube, and I believe this was from Sears also. I guess mom and dad had a Sears card, right? They had a five tube Sears AM radio in a white Bakelite, or maybe it was plastic, cabinet. And it was just about as big as a loaf of bread, right? And I would keep that thing in my bed. I had one of the bunks, I guess top or bottom, I forget which, on the bunk bed. My brother had the other. And I would listen to every night to KFH 1330 from Wichita, Kansas. And I would hear the news. They did a big newscast at 10 p.m. And then Cecil Carrier would come on and do the weather. And then they'd have the police blotter report and the sports. And then what would come on? The CBS Radio Mystery Theater. I had more nightmares as a kid. I'd listen to that show and I'd pull the covers up over my head and try to go to sleep without thinking about that show. Oh, man.
Technology has changed so quickly.
Is radio not like that anymore?
In some places I've traveled, it is. Not that it has mystery theater or that type of broadcast. I mean, you have, what's his name?
Garrison Keillor, sure.
Garrison Keillor and his style of radio, and there's still a few others doing it. But radio has lost to some degree, but I have noticed in some markets I've traveled to, usually a medium, I'm going to say medium to small, not to be derogatory, just to set a reference. The stations that are owned by smaller groups, privately, family, whatever you want to call it, not the, you know, the top 10, you know, ones that we all know and read about every day. They are the radio groups and stations that seem to do the tradition of communicating with the audience, you know, connecting, communicating, if you want to call it social networking in the broadcast vein. I'm not talking Twitter, Facebook, or anything else, Google Plus, but that's where I still hear it. And when you do hear it and it's done right, and it's usually done right, it's really good. I mean, it's engaging. You want to listen. You want to, you're on the edge of your seat, maybe, or you just sort of like, well, I don't want to turn this off. I've made it to my destination, but now I'm still sort of waiting for the next, you know, topic to come or conversation to continue. But the major markets, it's gone. Major markets, it's about, you know, how many songs can you play and how many commercials can we squeeze in and what excuses can we make today about why we're not allegedly making money. And you can hear it. If you listen carefully to most of the radio shows in major markets, they are not talking, they're not communicating with the audience, they're talking at you. And the few folks that are morning talk show hosts that do communicate are the ones you don't hear too much about anymore because they just, you know, people claim they don't make anything for them. I think Howard Stern was one of those guys too.
Who is who's talking to you, not at you?
Yes.
Hmm.
If you listen, okay. You know, I'll use Howard Stern as an example because he gets, you know, vilified too many times for unjustly and sometimes justly, but most of the times unjustly. And I've listened to him in the various markets for over 20 plus years. And he's probably one of five interviewers that you will come across in this industry that gets it right, that gets it when it comes to talking to somebody. When he can talk to Barbara Walters about the strangest things of her personal life and then change topics and continue to be current and not do anything in that conversation that was totally, you know, wrong, not wrong, I was going to say wrong, you know, out of place, unethical, yeah, or immoral.
Yeah.
It was literally a conversation between two people, and we had the honor or the pleasure of just sitting, you know, in the balcony and looking down and listening to the conversation.
What about
there was only a few, people that can do that and do it well.
The chat room mentions more than once here, Art Bell.
Art Bell was another one. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Another one that could do it. If you go back years and years ago in the New York City market, you had Long John Neville, who was well-known, a great talk show host. A lot of people made fun of him, but boy, did he communicate and connect with the audience. And there was a lot of folks that grew up listening to him across the country on, I think, was that the Dumont or Metro Media Network? No, Dumont Network, I think it was on early on. Metro Media, no, it was Metro Media. And, you know, that he's Art Bell, Long John Neville. There was even Paul Harvey for the commentary that he would do, you know, in the early years and when he was doing stuff before he made it really, really popular. So, yeah, there's a few folks out there.
I sure agree with the Paul Harvey thing. I was trying to think of when I was in, I went to kindergarten at a Catholic school in I want to say it was Lafayette, Louisiana. And the people that drove me to school, they came by and picked up at the house, had the radio on. It had to be a 10, 12 minute drive to school every day. And I want to say that we were almost always listening to Lowell Thomas. Does that name ring a bell?
Yes, Lowell Thomas. Absolutely. There's another one.
So, another one. The chat room mentions, and I was going to mention also, Larry King. Now, when Larry had a radio show, I felt like he was talking to me or talking for me.
Yes.
He always said that when he interviews an author, and he had a lot of authors on the overnight show there, but when he was on, what was it, the Mutual Network for years, yep, and he would not read the book that the author was coming in to talk about. Yeah, his first question was always, what's this book about?
Yeah.
Which is exactly what I wanted to know. What's the book about?
Well, you know, his approach in his early days and years later when he went to television, he was probably forced to change it a little bit because of TV and, you know, the visual. But his early radio shows, when you listen to his radio interviews, yes, a lot of people would make fun or comment that he wouldn't read the book and he's interviewing authors every night. You know, how do you do this? Why would you think to do that? I remember watching or listening? No, he was talking to someone, listening to a radio show, and he said, he goes, well, you know, when you have a conversation with somebody at the house, you're sitting down at a family table and somebody mentions about a book, you haven't read it yet, but you know that they've read it and they're talking about it. So you ask them, so what did you like about it? What am I going to get out of it? What, you know, what should I be looking for? And, you know, don't be the spoiler and tell me the ending, but let's talk about it. And I just sat there listening, going, you know, that's a good point. So now he's taking you, the audience, in with him. And now the author's sitting there on the hot seat going, yeah, you're right. You didn't read it. So, okay, what do I tell you? Yeah, well, this is what it's about. And I think sometimes if the author is a good, you know, communicator, they get it across. They get the point across. And you're sitting there going, wow, I'm going to pick that book up. I bet you he sold probably more books than most other people even realize
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Well, I think he realized it. It's probably a real...
Well, then
real
I shouldn't say he didn't realize it, but yeah. In the early days, I'm sure it didn't matter. And then all of a sudden it started to, you know, catch up. But, you know, you had it. Well, the other, what was it? Last week, watching on this network on Twit, Jerry Pournelle was talking about some stuff and, you know, his writings and what who inspired him. And he mentioned Long John Neville. I hadn't heard anyone in years mention Long John's name that was not in the radio business. And I'm saying to myself, wow, here's a guy who's inspired and who was influenced in part by this guy. And most people, when you mentioned Long John Neville to some people in radio, those of us that were around long enough to know it in the talk circles, a lot of people go, him? Oh, he was just a nut. Now, if you actually listen to some of the air checks, you go, wow, this guy really made sense. But, you know, Art Bell's up there with some of those guys. But a lot of them, they really understood. They got it. And that's what's missing in some respects. And, yeah, it'll come around. I'm sure it'll come back. We'll see more of it as the spoken word makes it on FM again and is moving from just music and now becoming maybe news, maybe sports, maybe full-time talk will come back. I mean, I know there's some markets in Boston. I think there's still an FM talk station there, and there's some folks in Chicago, or is it San Jose, that still has FM talk. But yeah, I think you'll see it come around.
Well, we could spend the whole show just going through names of people. A lot of them are regional folks. Some of the people who... some of the guys who fill in for Rush, I think, are sometimes pretty good. I can't listen to Neil Bortz up here where I live in Nashville, but he has some fill-ins that I think are occasionally fairly good. Folks on the chat room kept mentioning NPR. And what about NPR? What about NPR? Well, I'll grant you. Hey, I grew up listening to Bob Edwards all through my high school years thereafter. So I always liked Bob. His delivery was just wonderful. And, of course, the pipes. But you know who you always smile when you hear them are Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers. To me, that's good radio, although it's not produced like you might believe. You know, it's all outgoing phone calls to people who have, you know, submitted their questions earlier. So it's a highly produced show that sounds pretty off the cuff and natural. So I'll hand it to the producers for doing a fabulous job of that. So, yeah, that's one. Who's the guy that does What Do You Know? The What Do You Know show. I'll think of it, or I'm sure the chat room will. I'm watching for the chat room. It's yes, we've already talked about Howard Stern chat room. Yep, no problem. We already talked about that. No. Well, let's move. Okay, but now we have this nostalgia out of the way.
Michael Feldman, is that right?
Feldman, that's it, exactly. Thank you, Web 3485. Michael Feldman. He's a delight, I think. Although I've heard that if you go to a show in person in a theater, either when they're traveling or when you go to Madison, Wisconsin to watch, so people told me, you know, it's not very impressive in person. Well, it's a radio show, so it's all the magic is in the mind.
Absolutely, I could say the same thing. I had the opportunity to watch Paul Harvey do his commentary broadcast across the nation from his offices in Chicago. And other than the fact that I'm sitting in the same room as Paul Harvey while he's live to the nation, that was just, you know, just unbelievable in itself. Absolutely. To watch a radio show in person can be somewhat disappointing. But you know what? That's what radio is. It's about the mind. It's about, you know, I'll use that cliche. It's a theater of the mind. But you're painting words in someone's brain. And if you can do it right and you do it well, you've got yourself a success story. And there's a lot of folks that can do it. And that's why a lot of the radio folks who went from radio to television in the early days, when the technology developed itself, were successful and did very well for themselves because they knew how to communicate without the pictures. So now when they had the opportunity to do pictures, they added a dimension that they always had. You know, I'll use Bob Hope as an example. If you watch some of his early works and read some of the stuff that he did during his radio shows, he was a very animated person behind the microphone. So was Jack Benny. You put them in front of a camera. Now you see that animation that you didn't see visually. You only heard it and sort of, you know, subconsciously accepted it. Now you had both. And that's, you know, the rest is what you know. I'm not going to, you don't have to go any farther, but that's what it is. And that's where the technology, you know, even today with technology changing so quickly, as we're talking about being in black and white for 24 hours, the technology shifted so fast in the last 30, 40 years that sometimes I think people lost sight of, you know, what you can do. They just let the technology roll with it. It's like watching a great movie and you say, that was a great movie. Really, what was it? The special effects were unbelievable. What was the movie? I don't remember. Right? It's like it loses a certain, you know, pizzazz.
And could you say the same thing about, for example, the netcasts that are on this network, on the twit.tv network? You know, a lot of folks began or became aware of the Twit network when they weren't available on video, when the podcasts, right, or Leo calls them netcasts, were only available by download, by MP3, maybe streaming live from a variety of odd sources, and, you know, very mainstream now. But I still, you know, I'm sitting here in my office, I'll watch Security Now, and always something will come up, and I'll end up catching a grand total of 4 minutes of it. Whereas it downloads automatically into the to the iPod, it goes out to the car. When I'm taking the kids to school, pick them back up, going in the dry cleaning, going shopping, whatever it may be, that's when I get to listen to it. And my mind, it's like driving a secondary and automatic. Okay, but I'm listening to what Steve Gibson and Leo Laporte are saying. It's theater of the mind, and not that they're trying to create, you know, some world for me to imagine myself in. It's just easy. They paint such good word pictures. I think both of them do, both Leo and Steve Gibson, and there are other hosts that do as well. But that show in particular, I find better to listen to. What do you find audio only entertainment nowadays still worthwhile?
Absolutely. And Security Now is definitely one of those examples. And early on, I did the same thing. I still do to this day. And I enjoy both the video and the audible. I think the video adds a dimension that sometimes you don't even realize you're doing when you're talking and showing, and you can do stuff. It adds more. I enjoy it both. And I think this network is probably one of the few, if the only one, that really takes advantage of the technology, the people who drive the technology and get it, you know, those that do-it-yourselfers, basically those of us who just, you know, plain understanding, hey, this is what it's about. Let's be frank about it. We're not going to hide behind any, you know, superfluous stuff. This is what it's all about. And that's why it's successful and works as well as it does. And I think that's what's missing in a lot of places. That's why we do so well here, and we continue to grow, and everybody loves what they see and hear. And one of the things you have to remember, and I did some research on this a couple of years ago when we were moving studios at a previous job and trying to learn more about how my folks had worked the consoles we had just recently purchased, those IP-based ones, and found out that when you're reading or listening to something, whether it be a radio, well, I'll be biased, let's say it's radio, it's actually a part of the brain that is the emotional part, the imaginative part, that is absorbing and processing what's going on. I think that's the right side. And what happens is, if you now add the visual component, believe it or not, that is the left side, which doesn't process in the same way, and you don't experience that same, I guess I could say euphoric, you know, feeling. And that's part of the reason why when you're watching the Security Now and all of a sudden get pulled away, you lose sense of where I'm at, what happened, I just lost everything. Whereas when you're listening only, the brain that's needed for processing that is on its own. The brain that's needed for processing you walking, taking the kids to school, which is the left side, is doing its part. The two are not clashing. But when you're trying to do visual and audio, the two parts of the brain that are trying to do it and you can't. It's a psychology thing I looked up. Uh-oh, I lost my audio. What happened? Everything went dark on me. Lost audio. Hang on a second, folks. Oh, that's interesting.
Did Kirk mute himself?
I don't know. I hear you now? So I know I can hear cues. There you go. Look at that.
I was saying bad words, and so I thought I'd mute myself.
Oh, look at that. Self-censorship. Get out of here now. Go.
We should all turn our mics off and give you an idea of what SOPA would be like. Life under SOPA. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mute the microphones. You know, and speaking of the SOPA thing, we're going to touch on that a bit. It's been talked about, you know, I wouldn't say ad nauseum because I'm not tired of hearing about putting the thing down. But last night I was doing a little bit of research online, and I'm sitting in bed with the iPad, and I'm checking this link out and that link out, and do a little reading and making some mental notes, and I'm on a Wikipedia page, just doing some reading, and I click one of the links on the page, and of course I get the next page, and then immediately the black pop up, once you put your zip code in and tell you who your representatives are, and what Wikipedia could look like in a world filled with SOPA. And so I went back, and well, of course, the page I was looking at originally was cached in the iPad, so I could bring it up as often as I wanted to, as long as I didn't try to refresh it. But any other page I went to, and that, oh, and you know, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Not that I wasn't already totally not in favor of this kind of legislation, but man, gee, this is pretty effective here. Every place I want to go, I get a brief look at the page, and then bam, it gets covered up. And I know there were ways to, you know, to get around that. I didn't know that last night. Do you have any comments on this SOPA and PIPA stuff?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll add another P to PIPA and put a last name to it. And she's the sister of the queen. What do you call it? What's her name? Kate Middleton. PIPA Middleton. Yeah. Okay, that's where I'm going to put PIPA. And then when it comes to SOPA, I'm just going to say, let's see, take the A away. We'll just call it Standard Operating Procedure to get job done, and innovation continues. Quite frankly, I have no interest in supporting anything that tells me, sorry, you can't use your judgment in what you're reading, selecting, choosing, or whatever it is you're doing. And it's just, it's annoying. I think I mentioned to you earlier offline, but no, we weren't offline, we're online. I think of it in terms of, you know, a little town in Massachusetts called Salem, and everybody's complaining that last year's crop was poor, and as a result, they've decided to burn some people at a stake, figuring that next year's crop will do better. That's pretty much what SOPA and PIPA is about. And people like the we'll call the old guard in the media business, I won't name names so I don't get chased after anybody on the streets, they just basically don't get it. And they don't get it because they're surrounded by people who just want to make some money off them, and they're willing to say yes. If you're a owner of a huge, you know, media company that has newspapers involved, magazines, and you can't figure out how to use a tablet to extend your product and make it worthwhile for me to carry with me rather than have to carry the paper on the subway or on a bus or a cab, you're an idiot. Think about it. Yeah. It's technology has shifted. It's competition. Basically, SOPA and PIPA are a restraint of trade, a legal restraint of trade. That's what you're trying to do. And who in their right mind would even think to chase after somebody in another part of the world and claim, hey, you're infringing on my rights. I'm going to go and shut down my, you know, local guy because he's involved in something that you somehow got connected to, you know, inadvertently. I mean, come on. And that's, you know, it's like, it's again, it's there's no fair trade. If you don't like it, turn it off. Don't use it. You know, call somebody. Encrypt it. Find a way to do it. You know, what is it? O'Reilly Books. I've been using them, their technical books, for years. I think they've had e-books out on the market since, what, 1998 or 97? I don't hear them crying. You know, if there are ways to make this work. And, you know, first of all, if you keep this up with this attitude and this thinking, you're going to have more Borders bookstores disappearing because the Amazons of the world are going to buy them out, going to take their business away. Yeah, let's think about it. Borders. What were they thinking, giving their titles to some other company to do? Oh, that's right. Because somebody probably told them it would be cheaper, the bottom line could be increased, and you wouldn't have to spend much, and we would look better at it. Oh, right. You know, you're like the lambs to slaughter. And where are you today? They're gone. Let's see. What's about that other company? 1975, developed the technology. Yeah, they were drunk on the margins at the time of their other product. They decided, no, we're not going to do anything because really it'll cannibalize our core business. Today, that company is suffering. The product that they developed and nobody realized they were the first to do it and patented and just sat there and did nothing with it, Kodak. The product, digital cameras. Yeah. Today, where are they? Kodak, the number one distributor of film in the world, had margins so large they were drunk on them and decided the digital would be, we can't do that. Think about it. That's what SOPA and PIPA and a few other things out there do. Just leave it be. There are ways to make it work. But no, everybody wants to hold on to what they're comfortable with. I get it. It's psychology. I've done it myself. I'm sure we've all done it. But you have to think of it these days. Technology is shifting. Games are changing fast. And, you know, people like Steve Jobs and others, Wozniak and the gang, they got it. They understood. And they went with it. There's a lot of others that should do the same and think that way, and they don't. And it's just, that's why we're at this impasse. Again, it's just my opinion.
I think it's a darn good opinion. I think it's very well said, and so do a lot of folks in the chat room. So thanks for everybody's participation against that. I don't think there's anybody who watches this show or this network. There's nobody that I know of who is actually in favor of piracy. Nobody wants piracy. Sure, there's a few people who sample and taste, and go to Mexico City and buy any software program that you want to. But Soap and Pip aren't going to stop that. You can buy any movie
Mexico
that you want
City.
To.
Go to Canal Street, Manhattan.
Yeah, yes. Forgot about that place too. Soap and Pip don't stop piracy. They don't. They screw up. Legitimate activity for everybody else. And who knows how those things would have affected broadcast. It seems like, at least for now, for today, the SOPA is losing sponsors and co-sponsors on the bill. But I just read just before the show that, hey, they're going to try it again in February or in March. It's going to come back again and again until, you know, it's watered down to some point or they, attach it to some other legislation that has to go through and something will eventually go through. So this is not over yet. Hey, somebody like me being a pilot, every year we get pinged to write our congressman because the government's about to impose user fees on pilots. And of course, that's something that we don't want. We absolutely believe it makes the skies less safe because people won't pay them. And then they'll try to, duck under using the services that are available. They're already paying for in fuel taxes. Or tell you what, okay, let's have user fees, but take away all the taxes on airplane fuel. How about that? No, they want both. Hey, our show, you're watching, by the way, this week in Radio Tech, where we're talking about a lot of different things on this episode. It's Kirk Harnack along with Chris Tobin on this episode. And our show is sponsored by Axia Audio. We'll tell you more about Axia Audio in just a few minutes. But right now we're going to soldier on. And Chris, would you like to get to any of the little tech subjects we were going to get to this week? Does that sound good?
That's fine. Let me look at the list. Yes, light squared testing.
Light squared testing. You had done some research on this. Do you want to go ahead and jump into that? First of all, tell us about what light squared is, and it had something to do with satellites and close to GPS frequencies. Maybe interference there.
Right. It was a land-based. What do you call it? Land-based frequencies that are used by the mobile satellite service. I believe it's correct. MSSS. It's known as, and it's a set of frequencies that are used by, I guess, for a better understanding, people that use satellite phones, okay, like Globalstar or Iridian. They're probably names that no longer exist now that I think of it. There's a block of frequencies that are used by them. And within that, this company, LightSquared, I believe, found a way to get the FCC to say, hey, can we use this for a terrestrial broadband service? And not, as long as we don't cause interference kind of thing as a secondary service. And they said yes. Oh, and
Wait. Frequencies that were allocated for sat phone use.
I believe that's there. I try to remember.
Instead of transmitting from ground to sky and sky to ground, we're going to have transmitters and the transceivers on the ground and communicate. Some of this was for high speed internet, right?
Yes. Okay. And then it became a haul. Then it's still kind of sketchy because the testing that took place to prove there was no interference. The light squared folks demonstrated there was no interference. Then all of a sudden there's a GPS community that came back and said there is interference. Is why. Then they showed one or two charts to show a masking of the spectrum and indicate where the guard bands are and how it interfered. And then all of a sudden that information sort of disappeared and it became more behind closed doors as far as testing. And then the Department of Defense, I think, got involved. And then before you'd know it, all kinds of government agencies started saying, nope, it's not going to work. But nobody that I could find, I'm still looking, would show an actual report, testing, a benchmark, a baseline. Here's what was done, how it was done. Because the light squared folks are screaming, phrase bloody murder, that they're not being properly handled. They're being biased against in the technology. And that's where it stands at the moment. I believe, I got to look again because it's been changing so much.
Yeah.
The Commerce Department's getting involved now. And there's still controversy over launching this network because they claim it'll interfere with LTE networks. With existing and with too much with existing GPS systems. So now it's like, okay, LTEs, GPS, who's got LTE that's in the band that's near this? It's like, stuff still seems a little too nebulous in some areas. I'm trying to get my head around where and what's going on. So it sounds like the national space-based agencies in the government are giving LightSquared a tough time and not really explaining how they're doing it and what's going on. If they are, it's behind closed doors. There's no transparency that you can see or find that easily. That's where it's at the moment. So it's still up in the air.
Well, for this from, and maybe a little more background is in order, at least for me. I'm not entirely up to date on this, other than I keep hearing little whispers about interference or the potential for it. But from BGR.com, the headline is LightSquared's network still causes GPS interference, according to federal officials. LightSquared's intentions to build a brand new 4G LTE network has gained nationwide attention, but over the past few months, the attention has turned to the network's tendency to interfere with GPS devices. On Thursday, and this was back in mid-December of last year, so just a month ago, federal officials said they were still concerned about GPS interference despite a number of measures LightSquared has taken to address those issues. The company announced in late October it worked with PCTEL to develop a new antenna that resolves concerns over high-precision GPS receivers. Unfortunately, Department of Defense and Department of Transportation still see an interference problem with the network. And they said LightSquared signals caused harmful interference to the majority of general purpose GPS receivers. That's according to Anthony Russo, the director of the National Coordination Office for the Space-Based Positioning, Navigation, and Timing. He said that in a statement, LightSquared CEO Sanjeev Ahuja believes that LightSquared isn't at fault. However, interference issues are not caused by LightSquared spectrum, but by GPS devices looking into spectrum that is licensed to LightSquared. Well, this is actually an age-old problem. And you know what? It could be a situation that they're both right, all right? Right? LightSquared isn't transmitting into GPS spectrum, but GPS receivers are looking slightly wider than the GPS spectrum. And, this is usually a question of quality versus cost. If you want a $100 GPS receiver, chances are it may not, it may be susceptible to interference. Certainly the FCC, and by the way, this has been true, for aviation radios for years and years and years. And this is one problem that FM broadcasters have with locating FM transmitters too close to aircraft navigation aids, like VOR stations and ILS approaches, that an aircraft 75 miles away trying to home in on, trying to listen to a little bitty, whatever they are, 100-watt, 300-watt receiver, a transmitter on the ground with an ILS approach slope signal, they can be overwhelmed by a nearby FM transmitter on a not too far away frequency that can cause serious desensitization of the aircraft radio. Now, some would argue, well, the aircraft radios are crap. They're not filtering out very, very well. Well, that may be true. They cost a lot of money for something some people might describe as not good enough or crap. And the same is probably true of various GPS receivers. Now, what I don't want is for, a Southwest flight Boeing 737 on approach into Nashville carrying me to have its GPS interfered with by the local LightSquared transmitter giving somebody their web pages or their Foursquare check-in. So, what do you have to say about that, Chris?
Well, I agree that you're talking about blanketing interference from desired to undesired radio signals. We're all familiar with that if you've done FM measurements. Matter of fact, you can. Someone else has got an opinion about LightSquared. My dog. Apparently, it's a very touchy subject for her. But you're talking blanketing interference. We all experience that with AM and FM receivers. And if you're a land mobile operator or ham operator, you're familiar with that as well. And you're right. LightSquared could be falling into that trap where their signal strength is, say, 10 dB above that of the nearby GPS signal receiver and could be causing harmful interference. I question, one, if this is true and you're basing it on the mathematical facts that you should be using, then the FCC should have never allowed this license to even be permitted or this special temporary authority to test, because based on the math alone, it wouldn't work. So there's something to be said there. Maybe there is no truth in what's going on. Maybe the truth is very cloudy. Second, if there is a blanket interference condition, then what if we look at, say, you're a pilot and you have a NOTAM that you're reading or a notice to airmen statement. It says there is testing going on in this area regarding GPS transmissions may be interrupted. So what's the procedure then? What does the pilot do? How does the pilot know that their GPS is accurate, regardless of LightSquared or whomever is in the area? they travel through an area that's, say, heavily interfered with RF signals because of a military test taking place that, you know, as we all know, no one ever talks about. How do you know? You're a pilot. How do you know if your GPS is still accurate? Is there any indication that suddenly it's lost lock, that it's not accurate? You know, the RQ-170 went down in Iran because the GPS was tampered with and it lost communications and decided to fly what it thought was home. Right?
Eric Adler points out that an Extreme Tech article says the filter technology does not exist to isolate the GPS band from light squared's frequencies. Now,
that's right. There was an article.
And maybe it doesn't exist at any price, or maybe it doesn't exist at you know, the price of a $100, $200, or $500 GPS receiver. I got to believe that a $30,000 GPS receiver can probably, you know, put up with a lot.
Oh, yeah. There was an article. He's right. I did not read it in Extreme Tech. It was somewhere else. I read it late last year, that did discuss filter technology that you could use, but I think the price point was too high. But the claim was that the current filter technology being deployed or employed could work under the conditions, I guess, they're testing under, whatever the FCC's parameters were set for. And also their claims are the locations that these transmitters would be in vicinities where the odds of interference are much, much lower. It's, if you go back to the FM 50-50 rules when you did FM stations and you're talking about where the signal hit the ground as far as interference was concerned for contours and blanketing interference, I've worked on many apps where we were able to demonstrate through the antenna design that the signal never reached the ground where people, your listeners, could be impacted by blanketing interference on paper. Now, the reality is, you know, there's always a good chance that it did touch the ground. But the plan was the signal strength and the average receiver in that particular area, the receiver would probably 99% of the time overcome the blanketing interference because it's just that's the way it worked. Here, though, we're talking life safety. You're talking aircraft. You know, there's a whole different...
There's an interesting conversation going on in the chat room between a couple of people we know, Bob Holowenko and Eric Adler. And Bob is mostly from the computer and IT world, and although he's a ham radio operator. And Bob asks, hey, Eric, can't they do a DSP-type fix with phase shift? And Eric answers, well, they're on just adjacent frequency bands. You can't make a square filter. And I think those folks who grow up in the digital world are perhaps under the impression that, hey, a square RF filter, you know, one that goes like this and notches something out directly is possible, especially with, you know, some kind of DSP technology. And Eric Adler points out, well, Bob, it's not possible, not with the timing issues opposed by GPS. Now, Eric may be talking a bit over my head, but I know that, you know, to a even digital filters have, you know, finite capabilities and still impose some of the trade-offs that you get with an analog filter design. It's just not possible or not reasonable to you know, to have exactly square filters and that are, you know, infinitely good. So the problem comes down, I think, to practicalities when you're designing this kind of gear to protect one service from another, especially when you consider that the GPS signal is so tiny. It's just so small, and your little receiver is just trying to eke out enough of a signal to you know, to get that timing, to get that signal from the satellite. And you've got this light squared signal, you know, could be a half a mile away or 10 miles away, but it's going to be much, much bigger in terms of what it's putting into an antenna and into the front end of a receiver. So this little receiver has got, you know, some kind of what they used to be, you know, gas fed preamps. They may be, you know, better than that kind of stuff now, but really low noise amplifiers and you know, first stages to amplify the GPS signal. And I mean, a signal on an adjacent frequency is just going to really wreak havoc with that and totally mess up what you're trying to listen to. Hey, I've flown a small plane here in Nashville around the John Toon Airport, and the interference from nearby radio stations, 100 kilowatt FM stations, was so bad. Could not talk to the Nashville Tower. Couldn't talk to air traffic control. It was just impossible. If I would actually, you know, get the airplane in a certain position to where the airplane was shielding the airplane's antenna from the FM station, then I could talk to air traffic control. Now, was this a problem with the radio? Yeah, I think it was kind of a cruddy radio. but totally approved by the FAA for use in airplanes. And now the receivers aren't FCC approved. It's transmitters which are. But still, even with, you know, completely legal services and approved radios, it's possible to have interference to communications that is a danger to life. I was flying VFR. You know, I wasn't under the hood and I wasn't flying in the clouds. What if I had been? What if I had been flying VFR dependent on air traffic control and radar surveillance in order to make a landing, or dependent upon, you know, lining up the needles on the glide slope receiver, or depending upon a GPS receiver and a glass readout in the cockpit to land the plane safely? You know, things could end quite differently if those things are interfered with by a licensed legal service that you know, just can't work mathematically or in practicality.
It's beaten, all right, broken ribs and all. One of the things I keep reading about is Light Squared keeps making claims, and I haven't been able to verify it, that the frequencies that they're operating in the band was supposed to be vacated by the GPS industry years ago, I guess. I'm not sure if there was a shift. Maybe the FCC said, okay, you guys need to move here, and this is it. This is why this Light Squared licensing or permit allocation is being worked with. They're also, Light Squared's also claiming that their filtering technology that they're working with will filter out their signal or prevent their signal from reaching up to wherever this GPS guard band, I'll call it, is located. And that's the part that I can't seem to get straight answers. I'm still trying to find the frequency spectrum that they are using and what GPS is allocated for. But Eric's right about the square filter. You know, on paper, you could do a DSP and make it look square. And even if you could transmit and receive with a square, no sloping of the signal, or at least at a port that's operable, you know, operating level, you're still talking Raleigh effect, Doppler effect of a radio signal, whether it be digital or analog, and that in itself changes the game for filtering. After that, you're all done. So, you know, you can't just do a clean slope. It's even like if you're doing HD radio, you have the digital regrowth at the spectrum regrowth at the sidebands that you have to control. That's not a clean square way. You know, if you look at that mask, that's not a clear, clean, you know, 1, 2, 3 step line. So there's a little spectral regrowth you have to work with, and that's a very, you know, sticky area to play.
Skip Lives in the chat room points out FUD and politics always make it hard to get the facts. And boy, isn't that true? Because an article that we were just looking at about this GPS testing is now Light Squared is claiming that, well, the tests were rigged. You used defective receivers or super sensitive receivers that aren't typical, and that's what made the interference occur. Of course, I'm sure you could point the finger at the other way and say, well, Light Squared used some receivers that they knew were going to perform okay. Maybe they're very expensive or handpicked, just as they're claiming that the other guys were using handpicked receivers that did seem to receive interference. So it's so hard to know. But I know that as engineers, as RF engineers, and I'm not a design engineer, but I sure have a lot of practical experience. A good analogy for this, I think, is imagine you live in a New York City apartment, and you like your peace and quiet about 10 o'clock at night, right? I'm guessing that, you know, you like to go to sleep before midnight. And imagine you've got Megadeth practicing in the apartment next door. And then Megadeth says, well, there's strong, thick concrete walls between your apartment and ours. And there's strong, thick concrete floors and ceilings. We've measured, and the interference, you know, to you is very small, less than a dog barking, you know, in the next block. It shouldn't bother you whatsoever. And, you know, maybe they're right. Maybe if you measure it, it shouldn't bother you. But, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, you still hear the drum beat and the crazy wild screaming guitars. And that may be great at, 9 o'clock at night or later if you're partying. But that may not be what you want to hear at 2 a.m. when you're trying to go to sleep. And then what happens when you open a window because the air conditioner breaks and they open a window? Well, then all the protection, all the guard band is gone, and the system is broken down, and there's no way you're going to get any sleep. You're obviously interfered with, and I it just seems dangerous to put something like this technology, like what Light Squared wants to do. And I applaud them for wanting to find some spectrum and get this done. But GPS, we depend on that for life and limb every day, not just for me getting to the grocery store. You know, but for airplanes landing at every airport around the world every day, and even in fields that have no other approach to them. So, now, hey, let's we're going to turn our attention in a minute to a couple of other subjects. In fact, after after this word from Axia, we're going to be talking about satellite dishes and, you know, a couple things that can go wrong in windstorms, how to get those things re-aimed. And I want to talk about a fine that was issued upon an LP, a low-power FM station, and how that fine was reduced because the station couldn't pay or says they were too poor to pay. And, hey, I've argued that same argument myself, or my company has, for paying FCC fines. In fact, it's a pretty standard argument, I believe, unless you're, Clear Channel or CBS or Cumulus. Hard to claim poverty, but we're going to talk about that and whether you think that's ethical or not in just a minute. Right now, though, let's talk about our sponsor, which is, I'll tell you, it's my employer, Axia Audio. Folks at Axia Audio, these are the guys that spent several years developing how to put live, unbuffered audio over a standard IP network and do this at the layer 3 level so that it's routable. You can route Axia live wire streams even over Metro Ethernet. They're doing it in Hong Kong between two different facilities that are separated by the Hong Kong Harbor. That you can put these streams over over IP radios as long as they're good quality IP radios. Well, Axia developed LiveWire, and they developed it based upon standards and only added a little bit of secret sauce they had to get the timing right. So it's a technology that you might want to check out. There are white papers on the Axia website. Go to axiaaudio.com, and there's a button there called Knowledge. You mouse over that, you can see all different kinds of things to choose from, and one of them is white papers. From there, you can check out VOIP in the broadcast studio. Or my favorite is this one, Introduction to LiveWire 2.1. That was originally written by Steve Church. It's been updated, and it's pretty much completely up to date. We actually ship a copy of this this manuscript with each LiveWire product that goes out the door. But you can download it. Hey, if you have an iPad, put it on your iPad. Makes for great reading. You can flip through the pages and skip the stuff you already know and just read the stuff that you really don't know yet or want to find out more about. Now let's skip over to the products. There's a button on the front page, or actually on every page, called Products. Let's take a look at the Radius console system. This has turned out to be extraordinarily popular. There are hundreds of these now already out in the wild, out in radio stations around the world. Between the IQ and the Radius, and really they're based on the same technology, just a few differences in the console and the size of the rack mount unit, which we call the core, QOR, core. Leo Laporte has one of these consoles in his personal studio. The Radius console has these gorgeous LED meters. We designed these to just look really pretty. It has all the features, all the advantages of a console that can, memorize profiles. In fact, Leo in his studio has a profile that when he's taking Skype calls on his console, he loads one profile. When he needs to release those Skypeosaurus computers back over to the main control area at the Twit network, he just loads another profile, and those the talkback and the control of those are released back over to the main studio audio console. This thing is easy to operate. Simple on-off button at the bottom of each fader channel. There's a soft key and a little OLED display at the bottom of each fader channel to show you the status of what's going on. Of course, you can easily assign or deassign the program feeds. And there's a rotary knob and a push button knob there. It's the same knob, rotary and push button, at the top of each channel. Lets you easily select any characteristics about that channel that you need to quickly change. You can just grab that knob and change the gain. If you need a real quick change in mic gain, for example, or you get a real hot feed from another facility, you can just grab that knob and just crank it right down. It'll respond to you instantly. Or you can push the button and select from any of a whole bunch of different options available on the Radius. Now, this is true for the Radius, the operation I just mentioned, true for the Radius, the IQ, and the Element console as well. We are making these things very easy to use. Normally, you just load a profile and your show's on the air. And it operates exactly the way you want it to. But if you need to make changes, those changes are easily available. The Radius console has a U.S. list price of under $6,000. You talk to your dealer, no matter what country you're in, I think you're going to find it to be very, very affordable. The IQ console has a list price of just a little over $9,000, and it's expandable. You can get up to 24 faders on that thing for right around $12,000 for a 24-fader IP console. By the way, the Radius and the IQ, they include an Ethernet switch. It's built right in. And this Ethernet switch is pretty powerful. It also has gigabit ports to connect to other studios, and it has power over Ethernet ports. That means you can just plug one of our new VSET phones right into it, and that VSET phone will work. It'll get powered by the console. There's some a new line of products that will be coming out from Axia in the next few months that are also powered by these power over Ethernet ports. So cool technology, very standards-based. Check it out, axiaaudio.com. And I thank them very much for being the sponsor of this episode of This Week in Radio Tech. All right, Mr. Tobin, carrying on through some subjects here. Satellite dishes. This is something I was kind of interested in talking about for the winter time. We've had a number of windstorms around the U.S., but we do every year. And in my experience, hey, as good an engineer as I was when I was engineering radio stations, sometimes I didn't get satellite dishes locked down on their posts as well as they maybe should have been. Maybe I just wasn't strong enough or wasn't thinking to tighten the bolts tight enough. Or maybe no matter how tight you tighten the bolts, you get a strong, you know, a little gust of 60-mile-an-hour wind, and that big sail called a satellite dish, you know, might get bounced off course 5 degrees, and you know, the bolts, you know, drag a good strip around the pole that they're mounted on. What I want to talk about for a minute is you've got a satellite dish, and it's gotten blown off course. Not a terribly unusual situation, especially if you live in the prairie, or you've got a satellite dish up on a roof in an urban location. Let's talk about how you get that satellite dish back where it's supposed to be. And I guess the first piece of advice I would offer is when the satellite dish is locked in and you're getting a great signal, and the spectrum analyzer says you're getting a great signal, and the satellite receiver is really happy, you know, your EB over noise or your EBNO figure is really good, everything's fine, go out there with a nail or a Sharpie marker or something that's going to let you make a permanent mark on what's typically the satellite dish mounting collar and the pole to which it's mounted on. And, you know, inscribe a mark there so you know where it's supposed to be. Maybe you can line that back up later on. And then as far as the elevation is concerned, if it's a satellite dish, if the arrangement lets you make a mark between a movable item and a stationary item, well, you know, take a nail, take something sharp, take a scratch awl, and scratch you a mark there for the proper elevation. And then don't forget about the feed horn, because, you know, the polarity of that feed horn is pretty critical. So especially to null out transponder interference from adjacent birds. So, you know, get on your ladder, whatever it takes, and get up there. And again, the movable part, the non-movable part, put you a mark there and scratch it. So when this thing does get blown off course, you can go at least put whatever moved back to where it should be, and you might have a pretty good chance of being back on the air with it. All right, Chris, that's the preventive measure. That's what you do if you're thinking beforehand, which I'm not sure I ever really did, except once or twice. What do you do if the satellite dish is moved and you don't have it marked?
Oh, you pray for the best luck ever. No. Well, depending on how you lost your orientation, if you're fortunate enough that it just went left to right on the azimuth, the easiest thing to do is do not adjust the elevation. Do not adjust anything but the tightening ring that lets you go from left to right on its pedestal. And okay.
So you're assuming that the wind didn't change the elevation probably. It probably just changed the steering.
Most antennas, most satellite issues I've run into over the years and working at a couple of the networks with affiliates across the country, 98% of the calls were my dish swung to the left or to the right. It didn't go up or down. It just swung. It spun around. Because if you recall, some of the early satellite dishes, antenna systems, only had like a ring that clamped over two pieces of sliding metal. And, you know, you can do everything you can to lock it down. But eventually, the wind pounding against that catcher's mitt, will, you know, it loosens it up. So most of the time, it would go left or right, you know, on the axis. So the easiest thing to do is adjust nothing. Take your receiver if you can, bring it up to the dish so it's easy to do, and slowly turn in the direction that you recall it should be if it's not too far off. Or look up where you should be looking. Use a compass. Go to the website for the particular satellite that you need to look at. If it's radio networks, it's usually AMC 8. 139 degrees west longitude out there at 10 degrees above the horizon for those of us in the East Coast.
Yeah. And point it near the ground to work.
It pretty much just, just point out to the horizon and start from there going up and down. But if you're closer toward the west coast of the United States, then you're going to go higher up in elevation. And then, you can slowly bring yourself in and find it. If not, use a spectrum analyzer, look for the carriers, the digital carriers, and you can go from there. That's the quick and easy. Most of the time, that's what people run into. If you unfortunately have one of those mesh dishes, the semi-professional consumer type that you chose to use for economic reasons, which is well understood, and it's not only did it spin off axis, it sort of is now blue sky, looking up at the sky, the heavens, then it's going to be a little more involved. The best thing to do is get the information. Where's the antenna, the bird I'm looking at, the spacecraft? Is it radio networks? Is it some of the other private small state networks on the KU bands the CU bands in the center of the arc? Find out where that should be. What I did once, and it worked pretty well, if you use a protractor and you put it vertical to give yourself the elevation angle you want to work with off the horizon, it gets you in the ballpark. If you use a spectrum analyzer on the output of your LNB, hopefully using an LNB and not an actual LNA, and you can find the carriers and where they need to be. Sometimes you can lock in on there's a pilot tone, a pilot carrier that's at the end of this transponder on your particular satellite that you're looking at that you can lock onto, and that use that to tweak, and then you can sort of move into where your transponder channels are that you need to work with and tweak the dish that way. Because sometimes, a lot of the digital carriers on the satellites are tough to discern or make any sense of, and you wind up on the wrong one. And you're sitting there tweaking away going, this is not working. So you look for the pilot carrier. I think it's either at the top or the bottom or maybe both ends. The old GE SATCOMs used to have it on both ends. I'm not sure if SES, who took over the GE fleet, does the same thing. That's one of the methods you can use. Compass, to get a bearing as to where you should be looking into the sky somewhere in the west. Protractor is handy for just the elevation. And what else you can do? Those are the quickie ones. Or you can invest in, all those funky little toys that you can plug into and listen for the tone as it beeps and claims it's finding your carrier that you need. You only find out locked onto any carrier it saw.
I didn't know those location carriers were good for anything but, say, the DirecTV and Dish type satellites, where you've got a lot of installers out there. Not all of them, most of them, I'm sure, wouldn't have spectrum analyzers. They know how the receiver works, so they have some kind of a helper receiver. One of the problems that with so many receivers that radio broadcasters use is that there's not much on them, not many signals about them that help you aim the dish in real time. It's not just a matter of, it used to be a matter of swinging the dish until you heard the analog carrier, and then, move it left until it went away, mark that, move it right till it goes away, mark that, and put the dish in the middle of that. Do the same thing for up and down, and then do the same thing for the polarity of the LNB or LNA at the time. And wow, that usually got you in pretty good. But nowadays with these digital satellite receivers, there's so much time between acquiring the signal and playing something, and if it doesn't acquire a good enough signal, you're not going to get it. I mean, with an analog receiver, or back when there was some TV channels on some of these birds, analog TV channels, you could take an analog satellite receiver for television and easily, just look around the sky until you found the right things. But I think things got, and maybe I just wasn't up on the latest test gear, but I think things got a lot harder to aim when the satellite distribution companies went all digital. Not saying they shouldn't have, but the tools, the easy tools, went away for us to aim satellite dishes or re-aim ones that had gotten blown off course. A lot of times there may be an AGC signal available on the back, and I found that to most normally be pretty useless in tweaking up the dish for the best aim.
There's no easy way.
Yeah. Of course, spectrum analyzer is definitely the way to go, especially if what the transponder pattern should look like, what the frequency should be. I'm sure there's websites that show you what the typical population of the transponders is. Of course, that's subject to change, but you get to see what those kind of look like, and you can, oh, I'm on the wrong bird. And sure, several times I've been on whatever bird is at 137 degrees, AMC7 or GE7, but the bird of interest to most radio broadcasters is AMC8, also previously known as GE8. A little bit hard to find sometimes.
Yeah, for a few years. FR.
What's that? It's called what?
Those of us who really remember back in the day, it's SATCOM 1FR.
That's right. Oh, remember that.
You mentioned a website. Yeah, there is a website you can use, dishpointer.com.
Yeah, I'm on that now. Point from Manhattan to the bird of interest, you're pointing, 10.1 degrees up.
Yeah.
Wow. And a...
Good. Yeah, that's about right, because I used an address where I was managing a Earth station where we did transmit to that satellite from the building here in Manhattan, and the information on the website is close. It's accurate. So, you could use that as a starting point and give you an idea of where to go. If you're fortunate enough to work in a market where you have a television station, most TV stations have a satellite downlink or possibly uplink for network affiliation purposes and whatnot. I would suggest you take a run over there to talk to the TV engineers and see if anyone's interested in helping you out with pointing your dish, because they do a lot of satellite work and could probably, from their experience alone, be able to walk up to your dish, swing it, turn it, point it up, and go, okay, we're in the ballpark. Let's look at the spectrum analyzer. And within a half hour, you're done.
Yep.
Believe it or not.
You got that right.
It doesn't hurt to ask.
I'm talking in given a couple different procedures here. I'm talking about the difference between getting something back on the air, which may or may not work all the time, and what you really need to do is you need to have the dish aimed. The dish geometry all has to be good. Of course, the feed point has to be proper. The geometry of the supports has to be right, and then the exact distance, the focus, and the polarity or the skew of the the LNB and its antenna has to be right too. The idea here is to get not only the maximum signal out of the transponder that you're looking for in the sky, but also to minimize the interfering signal from adjacent satellites or adjacent transponders of other polarity. And to do that really, really right, there's just no substitute for a spectrum analyzer to get that done. Doesn't always have to be an expensive spectrum analyzer either. If you're looking at the LNB signal, what is that you're looking at? Is that around?
That's L band. That's 950 to 1450 megahertz.
Right. So
1.4, 2 gig. If you have a 2 gig spectrum analyzer, you'd be fine.
2 gig spectrum analyzer will absolutely do it. That's a couple of pieces of advice there. What I found toward the end of my daily career as an engineer, I found myself taking a digital camera, taking pictures of the satellite dish. And I tried, of course, get myself positioned like in the middle of the dish and above it, or in the middle of the dish and below it, and take a picture so that I could see the feed horn and some object in the distance. So I could see, aha, that building, that water tower, that house, that tower over there in the distance. I'm going to be about that far from it. So once the dish is set up and working, man, if you can document it, then you're going to be just all the much better off, for when you have to go make that thing right.
Right. One thing to bear in mind, if you are a radio station taking programming from a satellite service, one of the networks, and that is your sole source of programming for your radio station, it would behoove you to have some alternate means of getting that programming to your radio station in the event of a loss of signal, so that when you do have a dish issue, you're not under the pressure to get back on the air with something. You've already dialed up an ISDN or IP or POTS codec, and you've got to program back on the radio, everyone's listening and having a good time, and now you can take a deep breath and sigh and go, okay, now how do I fix the dish?
Or solar fade that happens twice a year.
Well, solar fade is planned. We all know that's coming every year, and if you're not ready for that, then that's a whole different topic.
For everything that could go wrong except solar fade, a second dish would be just great.
Yeah, if you have economics is okay. If you have the real estate to do it, some places you're lucky you can be zoned in for one.
Yeah, you're right about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I used to do what did we do? We did dual feed. We did two LNBs on the feed horn. sort of backup in case one would die. We had an extra large dish, and then we did, ISDN backups. Like, we had two ISDN codecs in a little communication shack at the base of the dish room, where we brought in the satellite stuff. And if we lost a signal for any reason, we just dialed up automatically to wherever we needed the programming, and then we sat and fixed the problem. Sure. Otherwise, you pull your hair out with your program director screaming at you, or general manager.
Chris, we have killed another hour of This Week in Radio Tech. Yeah.
Well, I hope we've enlightened some folks.
Yeah. I guess we'll have Tony on a different night. Good thing he wasn't here, because he wouldn't have gotten a word in edgewise.
Oh, he would. Trust me. Tony would be, I would just say this. I've known Tony a long time. Good man. Definitely somebody you want in the foxhole if there's a problem. But when it comes to telling a good tale, he's the man. When it comes to having a good time at an NAB show or an SBE conference, he's the man. And when it comes time to talking about technologies that work and make you money, he's the man.
Yeah. He's the man. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, a week ago, last week, when I was in Las Vegas at the CES, I got to sit down with Tony and with his cohort, Chris Verity, and knocked back a couple of drinks. By the way, we were just a couple tables away from someone familiar to this network. That is Colleen Kelly. Colleen was just a couple tables away and gave her a big hug. She's doing just great. And it's good to have her nearby. We just got to chat for just a minute before we had to go. But that's how I got really excited about having Tony on the show. He can spin a tale, and he's got a CES report for us, and he's got some very interesting ideas that may be controversial about what the radio industry should be doing about alternate delivery, where the peoples are.
You mean wake up and smell the coffee industry stuff? Oh, yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's controversial, though. That's definitely controversial for those that don't get it.
Well, that would be, some folks.
That would be a good percentage of the audience.
Chris, it's been a delight having you with us on the show. I really appreciate it. Chris Tobin, tell us where people can find you and the company that you work for.
Well, you can find me in the email at ctobin@musiccam.com, and I run the shop at Musiccam USA, CCS. So if you're looking for anything in the codec world, you have a choice. You can stop by and take a look at us, or you can look at the others, but you choose which way to go.
Good deal. And I think that either Tom or Chris Tarr will be back with us next week, and maybe we'll get maybe Tony will be available next week. So we hope so. Oh, we got to do a quick giveaway. Let's do that fast as we can. We need to, I need a random number here. And let's see. How about chat room? Throw out a few random numbers. I'll pick one. Just type them in. Random number between 1 and 31. All right. Cranky Hippo, 12. Somebody put in pie. Yeah. All right. Hang on just a second. We will.
145,000. Interesting.
Hang on. All right, here we go. Here's our winner. That was fast. 12. I've seen this person in the chat room. This was really just coincidental. I don't know this person, but they are from sunny-ish Florida. And this person goes on Twitter by the name of Agent X. Agent X. So Agent X, you stand by. I will send you a message. I think I can send it to you directly if you follow me. Yeah. So I'll send you a message. You've won and a fully licensed copy of Omnia AXE. This is a $500 list price product, and you can play to your heart's content about processing audio and streaming it for your own personal purposes or over the major interwebs. Up to you. As long as you do it legally, we don't care. So thanks again. Thanks to Agent X for retweeting the start of the show. Appreciate that very, very much. Thanks to all of you for participating. Thanks to Axia Audio at axiaaudio.com for being our sponsor on This Week in Radio Tech. Hey, thanks for all the participation in the chat room. I really appreciate it. We're going to see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
This program has been brought to you in Living Black and White.